Thanks for joining tonight's presentation. We are in the process of calling more than 28,000 Texas Medical Association and Texas Nurses Association members to join us tonight to learn about the Ebola response. It's going to take about 5 minutes to get everyone on the call. While you're waiting, let me explain the agenda for this evening. We will be having a presentation from Department of State Health Services, as well as introductions by the presidents of Texas Medical Association and Texas Nurses Association. There will be the opportunity later in the call at 7:15, you'll be able to begin asking questions by pressing zero on your phone pad. Steve, Brent, or Emily will be standing by to answer your call and place you into the queue. If you don't get a chance to ask your questions tonight, you can still leave it on a voicemail after tonight's presentation, and someone will follow up with you. Thanks for joining us on the TMA-TNA Ebola response call. We're in the process of calling more than 28,000 TMA and TNA members to join us tonight to learn more about the Ebola response. It's going to take a few minutes to get everyone on the call. While you're waiting, let me continue to remind you that you'll have an opportunity to ask questions later in the call at 7:15 when you'll be able to press zero and pound to ask your questions. Thank you again for joining tonight with Texas Medical Association and Texas Nurses Association. We are in the process of calling 28,000 members of those joint associations tonight to talk about the Ebola response. It's going to take just a few more seconds to get everyone on the call and to give them an opportunity to join the call. Let me remind you, at 7:15, we'll be able to begin taking questions after a short presentation by our presidents of Texas Medical Association and Texas Nurses Association, as well as then presentations by Department of State Health Services personnel in the branch of infectious diseases. You can ask questions at 7:15 by pressing zero on your phone pad, and Steve or Brent will be standing by to answer your call and place you in the queue. If you don't get a chance to ask your questions tonight, you can still leave it on voicemail after the presentation, and someone will be able to follow up with you. Because you can get CME credit, I have to read this line, so please bear with me. I want to remind Texas Medical Association members, you will receive 1 hour of CME if you stay on the call for the entire hour. Policies and standards of the Texas Medical Association, the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, and the AMA require that speakers and planners for continuing medical education activities disclose any relevant financial relationships they may have with commercial entities whose products, devices, or services may be discussed in the content of the CME activity. The content of this material does not relate to any product of a commercial interest. Therefore, there are no relevant financial relationships to disclose tonight. Let's check the progress of our call. We are almost there. We're at 93%. We're getting close. We want to thank you for joining us tonight with the Texas Medical Association and Texas Nurses Association. We're in the final seconds of dialing and calling 28,000 members of the both associations together. We'll be discussing the Ebola response tonight with special guests from Department of State Health Services, along with the presidents of Texas Medical Association, Texas Nurses Association, and key public health leadership of the Texas Medical Association. Okay, we are ready to begin our call. I want to introduce who we have with us tonight. We have with us Texas Medical Association President Dr. Austin King, who will be joining us. We have Texas Nurses Association President Margie Dorman O'Donnell, Dr. Lisa Cornelius, who is with the Department of State Health Services Branch of Infectious Disease, and she is the medical officer. Dr. Michael Fisher, who is a DSHS epidemiologist. We have Jessica Ross, also a DSHS epidemiologist and infection control. We have Jim Willman with Government Affairs of the Texas Nurses Association. It's Executive Director Cindy Zolnarek, Dr. Cindy Zolnarek with the Texas Nurses Association. And then we will have Dr. Phil Wong, Medical Director and Local Health Authority for Austin-Travis County Health and Human Services, and Dr. Chip Riggins, member of the TMA Council on Public Health and Scientific Affairs, and also the Health Authority for Williamson County. They will all be on the call and available to answer questions tonight. So at this point, I'm going to introduce Dr. King and thank him for joining us. Dr. King.
Yes, sir. Good evening. This is Dr. Austin King. It's an honor to represent physicians as president of the TMA and to speak directly to you this evening. I'm so pleased to be working with our partners, the Texas Nurses Association, and pleased that our two organizations could put this call together because we share not only the privilege of treating and hopefully curing our patients, but occasionally the risk that goes with that responsibility. We're coming together tonight both as citizens of the state and as professionals charged with protecting the health of our fellow Texans. As healthcare workers, parents, friends, and neighbors, we are understandably concerned by the news from Dallas over the past several weeks. But as doctors and nurses, it's our job to know and to stay up to date on the science surrounding Ebola. It's our job to impart that information to our patients, and it's our job to make sure we and they are aware and prepared and concerned, but not panicked. So tonight it's our job, the job of the TMA and the TNA, to empower you with the information that you need. I want to thank DISH Commissioner David Lakey and his team for working with us to keep us informed, and I also want to commend the healthcare workers, but especially the physicians and nurses of Dallas County who have demonstrated what it truly means to be physicians and nurses. So thank you, and thanks for participating in this.
Thank you, Dr. King. Appreciate it. We want to remind our callers that you can get CME credit if you stay on the line the whole time with us this evening. You'll be able to get 1 hour CME credit, and you'll be able to get instructions from TMA on that. Our next speaker, I wanted to welcome our nurse president for the Texas Nurses Association, Margie Dorman O'Donnell. Ms. O'Donnell?
Yes, sir. Thank you to each of the panelists tonight, as well as to Dr. King and all of the members of the Texas Medical Association for allowing Texas Nurses Association to work in partnership with you on this response to our Ebola event. We are delighted that you have included us tonight. I think it speaks worlds about the fact that in Texas we work in partnership and collaboration, and that's what we want to promote tonight as we work together to answer questions. We believe that working in partnership with each other, as well as our hospital members and members of the Texas Hospital Association, that's how we're able to promote the environment of safe choices and just culture here in Texas. So we're delighted to be able to participate tonight. I have gotten a text on my phone that some members have gotten cut off when they were roto-dialed, and I'm wondering if there is a number that they can call in, or do I need to direct them on my phone back to the website?
We'll get that information for you in just a moment.
Okay. Thank you very much. We are delighted to be on tonight.
Okay, thank you, Margie. Now I'd like to quickly move to Department of State Health Services for a few short comments, an update from Department of State Health Services. Dr. Lisa Cornelius.
Hi, good evening. Thank you for joining us. I don't want to repeat what's been in the media, but I do want to point out that there are key differences between the Ebola cases in the United States and the West Africa outbreak. West Africa lacks important mechanisms to control the spread of disease, which the United States has long had in place, and these include modern care, the ability to isolate, and hygiene standards in the healthcare facility system, as well as public health interventions to stop the spread of disease. Ebola preparedness in healthcare facilities, including ambulatory outpatient settings, is very important, and healthcare workers and facilities must maintain vigilance to prevent infection spread when providing care for a patient with known or suspected Ebola disease. Healthcare workers, EMS personnel, and facilities should ensure that a travel history is taken to determine whether travel to West Africa has occurred in the last 3 weeks. Since the outbreak of Ebola began in West Africa, the CDC provides updates, has held webinars and conference calls, as well as issuing guidance documents on Ebola preparedness and response to healthcare facilities and workers. The Department of State Health Services in Texas is available to provide assistance as individual cases are managed and as facilities ensure their protocols in order. And this includes assistance in monitoring progression of symptoms of suspected Ebola cases, assistance determining the appropriate diagnostic testing that would be indicated, guidance on appropriate isolation and infection control protocols, and advice in the contact investigation process. There are a few measures or instructions that you can provide the public and your patients to reassure them of their risk of Ebola or exposure to Ebola. And this includes the only people at risk are those who might have had direct contact with a person with Ebola disease. Individuals can take precautions against Ebola, including careful hand hygiene to prevent the spread of viruses, as well as avoiding contact with blood and body fluids of individuals who are ill. People who suspect they may have Ebola, including recent travel to West Africa or exposure to a case of Ebola, should seek medical attention immediately. And this includes a pre-notification made to the doctor's office or emergency room about their symptoms so that the provider can prepare for appropriate infection control. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Cornelius. I want to remind everybody we're going to move into a time of questions. You can press zero on your phone pad, and someone standing by to answer your call and place you in the queue. We do have a couple of questions to go to at this time, and then we're going to go there and be able to begin to allow these callers to ask their question. For first caller is Kimberly Nelson. Go ahead, Kimberly.
Hey, I'm just kind of curious about the transmission because I know that we keep talking about the transmission through the body fluids, and I understand that, and I can completely see that through how the nurses may have gotten that through doffing the PPE, and I understand that. I'm just curious about that because it makes me wonder because, see, we're being told that it's okay to be within 3 feet of somebody with Ebola without being covered from head to toe. But then I see on television that everybody's being covered from head to toe. So
okay.
I'm just curious why that's okay.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to let Dr. Cornelius begin to respond. And we've also just had some new guidelines that came out from CDC just a few moments before the call started. So,
okay.
Right. So if you look at what's on the CDC website now and you look and see what's on TV, they are different. There has been presentations by Dr. Ribner, the physician who cared for the patients at Emory, and the way he has described it is that they're not doubting the science behind what the CDC says. It's more an issue of practicality. He said some of these patients lose 15, 20 liters of volume each day through diarrhea and vomiting. And just from a practical aspect, their traditional, you know, disposable gown and shoe covers doesn't provide adequate protection when a nurse is spending 4 hours in a room with a patient because they do have one-on-one nursing that is dedicated to those individual patients. And so in their experience, what they found was that it's just more comfortable for their staff to be in a full gown so that, one, they can have visibility. The patient can see their face. They're not worried about the goggles or the face shield fogging up, and provides adequate protection against the bodily fluids.
We've got another question. Thank you, Dr. Cornelius. Ms. Ladler.
Hi. I was asking because in a particular facility where I work at, we designated an area for Ebola care to be on the 7th floor of our facility. So how, in, you know, minimizing from where our ambulatory care, I mean, where the patient would enter you know, to the hospital and getting the patient all the way up to that area of care, what could we do to minimize exposure along the avenue of getting on the elevator and traveling to that area, you know, to get to where our critical care areas are? So, and even in that area, that is not, a critical care area. So in the event that the patient needed anything else of a, you know, of a higher grade or stature, we would have to bring that patient, I guess, either down to the area or whichever. You know, I'm not under full understanding of what we can do to minimize exposure to other people.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Ross is going to respond.
Can I ask you what type of facility that you work at?
Oh, she's not able to respond now.
The best recommendation I could give, too, would be to have the closest room available. You would want a private room with a private bathroom, and again, making it the closest room that you can. If you do have, if the seventh floor is the closest you can, given that that's where your critical access rooms are going to be, again, making sure to contain that patient and any type of vomit or diarrhea that the patient has as much as possible while transporting.
Thank you, Ms. Ross. I want to remind you, you can press zero on your phone pad and someone will answer to take your call and place you in the queue with your question. If you don't get an opportunity to ask a question tonight, you can still leave it on voicemail and someone will follow up with you. I want to also remind TMA members that the Ebola Resource Center is at www.texmed.org/Ebola. That's www.texmed.org/Ebola. Okay, we've got another caller. Let's go to our question line.
Hi, I just wanted to find out if any of the infection control specialists know which strain of Ebola Mr. Duncan had.
This is Ebola Zaire.
Okay.
Dr. Fisher is responding that it is
Zaire. It's Ebola Zaire.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, our next caller. Reminder, you can press zero and, on your phone to answer, ask questions. Ms. Carrillo?
Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
Well, my question is, I'm hearing that Ebola is from West Africa, and West Africa is a continent, very large. And, you know, everybody, you know, we're thinking everybody from Africa is experiencing Ebola. Can you be a little bit more specific? Where in the part of West Africa is this Ebola very rampant? And if there's anything the World Health Organization is doing to help these poor people?
Okay.
Yes.
Dr. Fisher.
Yeah, so Ebola typically is not in West Africa. However, this is the first outbreak in West Africa. It includes the countries in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. Typically, we see it more down, a little bit more central and south of where it is this year. Nigeria was also included in this outbreak a little bit later on. But those are the areas we're working at, the west coast of Africa, and it's just above the central area of Africa.
Next question.
Yes, how are you doing? My name is Carlos Roldan. I'm a board-certified family physician in San Antonio, Texas, and we are a practice of 10 primary care physicians. And my questions is combined. Number one, do I have, from the medical legal aspect, do I have any responsibility or I will be open to litigation if we as a group can refuse to see any patient with possible Ebola and we refer to university hospital, considering that we're not capable, and I don't think that any primary care practice is capable of handling these cases. And number two is for how long the bodily fluids are contagious, either
okay.
Saliva, diarrhea, or anything. Thank you.
Okay. Who would like to handle the bodily fluids question?
there's not a lot of information known in terms of the virus, but it's felt that the virus is not a very hardy virus environmentally. So once bodily fluids are dried, there's not a significant infection risk, and it's easily cleaned or disinfected with the standard EPA disinfectants that are registered for non-enveloped viruses.
Thank you, Dr. Cornelius. Reminder, everyone, you can ask a question by pressing zero on your phone, and someone will be standing by to answer your call and place you in the queue. Also, a reminder, the TMA's Ebola Resource Center is found at www.texmed.org/Ebola. The Texas Nurses webpage is www.texasnurses.org for more information. Our next question.
Hi there. I work in a freestanding ER. I'm a board-certified ER physician, and I was wondering if there will be designated ambulances in each city to take these folks to more full-service facilities, either from a doctor's office or from something like a freestanding ER urgent care.
Okay. Dr. Phil Wong is going to answer that question.
Yeah, in Austin, you know, with some of the patients that we've been monitoring, we've actually made arrangements with them and have actually implemented this where they've driven to the hospital themselves if they can, and we've met them at the hospital and also then provided information to the hospital infection control practitioners so that the hospital is ready to receive them. They've waited in their cars until they need to actually, the hospital is ready to receive them. When we've had some controlled situations like that, that's what we've tried to do. Thus far, I don't think in Austin we've had designated ambulances for that purpose. I can double check on that, but then they have, I know our EMS does have a pretty robust decontamination capability afterwards that they've shown us. So.
Thank you, Dr. Wong. We've got another question from a nurse. Go ahead, Ms. Weaver.
Yes. Do you suggest that all nurses that are caring for Ebola patients, do you suggest that they all wear hazmat suits, full hazmat suits?
Ms. Ross.
At this time, the CDC is putting out new guidelines, and I apologize. I don't have what they literally posted 5 minutes before this meeting in front of me, but if it's not up right now on the CDC, they did state at a call this morning that they should be posting their most updated guidelines for PPE tomorrow or sometime this week. So I would refer you to those guidelines put out by the CDC, and that is what the state of Texas is also following.
All right, let's go to our next caller. Remember, you can press zero and pound on your zero on your phone, and you'll be placed into someone who will take your call and place you into the queue. Next call. Dr. Seltzer.
Good evening. My name is Lamont Seltzer. I'm calling from the Texas Medical Center, Houston, Texas. I'm a retiree from the military, and I guess I'm a firm believer, not necessarily reinventing the wheel. At the state level, we have people that have already, or we have units that have already trained in this. Why haven't we reached out to the U.S. Navy as well as the U.S. Army for guidance with transport and containment? You know, let's buy fluids. That's easily contained. Once you're in your level A or your MOP A or MOP B, C, D gear, or your variant PPE, cat litter. There's
okay.
So many different ways to go about treating this, but we're trying to recreate something that's already in play. The Army and the Department of Defense have already created protocols for treating toxic agents. So why aren't we networking? Why are we waiting for the CDC to manage an issue that
has
already
been tested? Let me get you an answer to that question.
A lot of it has to do with what's federal, what's state, you know, laws and regulations, and when you can bring in military to do things. We do follow a lot of the guidelines that were developed and established through the military, but they still have to be, you know, within what fits with our constitutions and our laws.
Great. Thank you, Doctor. We have about 10 people in the queue, and we're going to keep going to our next calls. Remember, you can press zero to enter into the queue to ask questions. Next caller.
I'm an anesthesiologist in Waco down here, and I read that the persistence of the virus in moist, dried blood surfaces, carpets, things like that, can be as much as 6 weeks. And also, there's been studies where persistence in semen, sweat, and other bodily fluids, even though they're symptom-free, defervesced, and test negative, still is there. So that's sort of my concern is, what are you going to do with their car when they drive up to the hospital? Blowtorch the inside of it?
Dr. Fisher.
They done tests, cultures where they did a culture in lab, and under those conditions have been able to keep the virus alive for 50 days. And 6 hours under a contained laboratory, 6 days in a contained laboratory environment on tap. That gives you a rough estimate of, you know, if it's left alone and there's no environmental agents and it's not put in a moist environment to actually allow it to grow on a cell culture, 6 days, what we're looking at.
Thank you, Dr. Fisher. We've got another call. We've got a nurse, Deborah Meeks.
Yes, my question again is about PPE. Looking at all the points of entry into our facility, and we are doing screening of patients at each point, and realizing the stigma that surrounds these patients that may not have Ebola but may have had a fever or symptoms, what is your recommendation for reasonable protection for the triage nurses or triage areas where it won't create hysteria? And I had a second question about pregnant patients. Have you had anyone infected with the Ebola virus deliver a baby, and what do you do with the baby and mom? Do you board them together or separate them?
Ms. Ross is going to handle the question on the PPE.
Okay, as far as PPE, again, good triage with any patient. Remember, it's allergy and flu season, so good triaging of patients is extremely important. Anybody coming in with flu-like symptoms or a fever, putting a plain surgical mask on that patient will help alleviate a lot of that. And then basic, you know, contact and droplet precautions for ER staff as well. And going into your pregnancy patients, if you research a lot of pregnant women with Ebola, the mortality among pregnant women with Ebola is typically about 96% death. Also, pregnant women with Ebola viruses are typically at a higher risk for spontaneous abortion, so it's extremely rare to actually have a mother carry full term for being pregnant with Ebola.
In a follow-up to that question on PPE, we had another question online about what point do nurses put on PPE?
Again, same thing, following your basic infection control guidelines. If anybody comes in symptomatic with flu-like symptoms or a fever, they need to have their PPE on. Contact precautions is extremely important with a patient vomiting and diarrhea, and also, again, droplet precautions or even airborne TB, flu, meningitis, any type of infectious disease.
Hi, this is Cindy Zolnarek, and I think if nurses keep in mind that how we've always been taught that you apply the protective equipment based on what your exposure is. So if you're speaking with someone and you're not in a position to be exposed to blood and body fluids, you know, you don't need extraordinary PPE. It's based on what the situation is. So like a nurse in triage who may not even be touching the patient may not need the application of PPE. So nurses should use their judgment as they know how to judge what their exposure is and then what PPE to don to protect themselves.
Okay, and I ask Dr. Cornelius to answer the question about the pregnancy question that was asked. Oh, you already answered that. I apologize. Next caller.
Hello?
Yep. Yeah.
Hello?
Go ahead, Dr. Jimenez.
Okay. My question is, if a hospital receives one of these patients, what would be the protocol for cleaning that facility or that particular room? And the second question is there an obligation for the hospital, the physician, the responsible party to notify the next patient that would be using that room after that patient leaves? Thank you.
The main thing is you want to see if that patient truly meets case definition for Ebola. If they do, then we have specific guidelines for the state, whether we have a third-party vendor that actually comes in and cleans and disinfects that room, just like we did with the apartments and the cars, the vehicles of those patients that tested positive. And again, basic hospital-approved, EPA-approved disinfectant for non-envelope viruses is what should be used for disinfection.
Okay. Reminder, you can press 0 on your phone to enter in questions, and someone will be standing by to answer your call and place you into the queue. You can also go to TMA's Ebola Resource Center at www.texmed.org/Ebola, or you can also go to www.texasnurses.org. Let's go to our next caller, Mr. Vasquez.
Hi, yes. My name is Pablo Vasquez, a registered nurse here in North Houston. I kind of have two questions, slightly different. The first question is in regards to, obviously, in the light of the events that have happened recently, historically, as healthcare facilities, most of us have not really, quote-unquote, played well together. We kind of each do our own thing. You know, in the background, as clinicians, we're part of TNA or TMA, and we all do a lot of collaboration. But I've noticed where I live, you know, within a five-mile radius, we have three acute care facilities that are between 200 and 300 beds, and we've all been kind of running around with our heads cut off trying to do, you know, get our staff prepared, make sure we have the right PPE, and we're all doing something different. So obviously there's not a lot of efficiency in this redundancy, and I don't know if in light of all this, there's hopefully plans of trying to have a more unified approach to training and collaboration. So that's my first question, is at least hopefully maybe as our organizations, TNA and TMA, working together, if there's some sort of spinoff that we'll explore further. And then my second question is in regards to the announcement of the governor putting this task force for infectious disease preparedness and response. And I'm just curious if anyone in the panel could elaborate a little bit more about what the goals of that task force is going to be and what we can look forward to as providers, either in contributing to this task force or in participating with plans.
Okay, the first one's going to handle the first question by Ms. Ross.
I think that's a good question about training, and I think a lot of that, unfortunately, is being devised at this time from the CDC as well. I know the Texas Department of State Health Services will also potentially be working with APIC, which is the Association for Professionals in Infection Control, and to also get some good training, again, especially for PPE and for our direct healthcare workers.
And then Dr. Wong's going to answer the second part.
I know that there's the task force has invited testimony this week from various organizations, including TMA, and some of the things that they're specifically looking for, how these different organizations and, I guess, improving education, early identification or public response to Ebola or other contagious diseases of high consequence, how to help ensure that any additional Ebola patients will be identified on their first symptomatic encounters, receive appropriate isolation and public health notification. They're looking for best practices, including training, exercises, other assessments, which could serve to ensure Ebola patients will be identified at the earliest possible time, looking at ways to improve information and guidance from the federal, state, and local sources about Ebola or other contagious high-consequence diseases, and seeing if there's sufficient timely education regarding other Ebola and other potentially contagious diseases, and also looking at any barriers in preparing for Ebola, influenza pandemics, or other contagious high-consequence diseases, and any specific actions that it might be recommended at local, regional, state, or federal levels to improve overall preparedness and response to infectious diseases.
The governor's task force that he referenced is meeting on Thursday and will be taking testimony. Both Texas Medical Association and Texas Nurse Association have both been invited to present testimony. He'll be speaking at that event. Let's go on to our next caller, but first let me just remind you, press zero on your phone to speak to someone and be placed in a queue. We have a number of folks waiting in the queue to ask questions. Our next caller, Mr. Tosh.
Yes, hi, my name is Gary Tosh. I'm an RN, and I understand that the current Ebola patients, that their viral load has been extremely high, and I'm wondering, with in light of what happened to the two healthcare workers at Presbyterian, what is the possibility that this virus has mutated and become airborne?
I think the first of all, I don't believe that there is a theoretical risk that yet has not, it hasn't been proven, I don't think, in any virus to change from one sort of form of transmission to becoming something like airborne. It's never been proven that it occurs, but it's theoretical and it's believed that it might. So it really still keeps it at a very theoretical risk, but that possibility always remains.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Fisher. Next call. Ms. Bradley?
Yes. I'm Sharon. I'm an elementary level school nurse, and my question has to do with the protection of, and prevention of spread, and maybe even identification of the symptoms of a child that enters the nurse's office with signs and symptoms. This may have been answered previously when it comes to the PPE, but I'm just trying to identify what is the best precaution to take with that level student where you can't get a good history of where they may have traveled or parents may have traveled. What's the best way to deal with that symptomatic child?
Okay, thank you. Ms. Ross is going to answer.
We're currently, if not already, putting out these recommendations for schools. We're working with the TEA, DSHSs, but currently right now some of the recommendations are typically these patients are highly having they're acutely ill, but if you do get a patient that comes in or a student that comes into the office, one of the best things to do is, again, find a private room with a private bathroom as close as possible to isolate that student away from the general population, and then you want to immediately notify your local health department. If you don't have a local health department, also notifying your regional health department, and they'll have further guidelines at that point. Making sure, too, that you have at least plain surgical mask and an impermeable or fluid-resistant gown and gloves, and that all should be available, too, just from having your bloodborne pathogen exposure control plans in your schools as well.
I'm going to allow Dr. Wong to also address that question.
And just one thing, I mean, to remember, this is extremely low chance of this coming into your school nurse setting. And so, I mean, any preparation, it's really what you would normally do in infection control for any child that you might see coming in your office. Again, this is very rare. Right now we have, I guess there are three people in the entire country. I think the NBC News man is still out there. So it's highly unlikely that this will just be what walks into your nursing station.
I also want to mention that Texas Medical Association put out some communication over the weekend to schools, and that can be found on www.texmed.org/Ebola. You'll be able to find that information there about our communication to schools and some resources for schools to use. And that was communicated to TEA as well as the major teacher and different education-related groups. Let's go to our next caller. Go ahead.
Dr. Hi.
Yes.
Is this my turn to speak?
Yes, please.
Hi. This is Dr. Vani Velathini. I was calling to find out where can I get the specific gowns and the masks, because I tried to call McKesson, and they're quite back-ordered is what they said.
Any resources there? Let's go to Dr. Riggins on the line and see if Dr. Riggins, are you available to answer the call?
Hi, Troy. I think the question had to do with the backlog of ordering
yes.
of equipment. And, yeah, there's several things they could do. They can contact their Regional Advisory Committee for Trauma. They've been overseeing the hospital preparedness efforts since 9/11 and stockpiling some of this equipment, and they could contact them until this backlog is resolved. I've heard of other first responder groups also going through the network and through their internal networks to try to temporize and find equipment.
Thank you, Dr. Riggins. I want to remind everybody you can press zero on your phone to enter the queue to ask questions. Let's get back to our next caller. Go ahead, Ms. Addison.
Hello, yes. My name is Annie Addison. I'm a nurse practitioner here in Grand Prairie, Texas. My question relates to, I work in primary practice, and what do I do if a patient presents to our practice with symptoms of Ebola?
Hi, this is Jessica again. It's the same thing really for any clinic, private physician's office, schools. A lot of the times, again, your risk is fairly lower than an ER or a hospital of these patients showing up at your clinics. If they do, though, again, recommending and putting in place a private room with a private bathroom away from the general population. If the patient calls in before they show up, if you can deter them from even showing up to the clinic and going to an ER or a hospital first, but if they do again show up, having that private room, placing the patient in standard contact and droplet precautions, and again contacting your local and regional health departments to notify them and work with them also on transportation too. We've had some problems with EMS transporting patients from private physicians' offices, so making sure you have that in place prior to a patient showing up at your clinic.
I want to mention that DSHS and TMA both have on our websites access to information on the main page, the Ebola page, related to finding your local health authority or regional health contact. Dr. Wong also is going to answer that question.
And I think your question was also initially if someone comes in with symptoms of Ebola. And so, again, it's very unlikely with the symptoms. The symptoms are pretty nonspecific. So the first thing is to ask the travel history and ask if they were in any of the three countries in West Africa that have active disease transmission going on, which right now are only Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea. And so it's not all countries in Africa. And that's where we get a lot of false sort of questions or false concerns. It's only if they came from one of those three countries in the last 21 days or have contact with someone who's known to have Ebola, say, in a healthcare setting or something like that. But it's not everyone who comes in with the symptoms. You know, the symptoms are very nonspecific, so you have to hone it down further, much further from that with those questions.
Now, I just add that, yeah, a good clinical, you know, in history, do a good history and on clinical, and we can pretty much rule out those that don't, you know, need to be investigated farther, and those that need to, we can move quickly on.
Okay, let's go to our next caller. Ms. Wingo.
Hello, I'm Dr. Wingo calling from Amarillo, Texas. We had a recent scare here where a patient presented to the emergency room with a history of being in contact with somebody who might have been in West Africa and having a low-grade fever. I was wondering, given that this put the hospital on lockdown for several hours, if there was any thought given to establishing a hotline where patients who were concerned that they might have a risk of Ebola can call in and be directed to the most appropriate facility rather than showing up at a random small clinic, you know, small hospital or regional medical center.
Okay. Dr. Cornelius or Dr. Fisher.
Yes. Call your local health department. They're the first place you should be calling. They have good information to get out to you. I believe there's also a 1-800 number for CDC has out there that people can ask questions, but your local health department is a good place to start for that.
Next caller, Dr. Hello? Martinez.
Yes, I was wondering if being so rampant in Africa, HIV, if some of these patients, especially the one that crashed so badly, have also HIV, and is it being detected together with the Ebola, you know? Number two, I wonder if insect vectors have been possible as transmitters to the Ebola. Also.
Dr. Fisher.
Well, that is possible that can be either, there is co-infections with different things. What we do see more likely is that malaria comes into play. Someone coming in with a fever, certainly anywhere that there's HIV is present in that community, that is a possibility, just as malaria is. But right now, these countries, their programs for malaria or for any public health programs are pretty much stopped right now. So those diseases are not being controlled as well as they had in the past. So they're definitely a concern.
All right. And about vector control?
Vector control. And that's, the vector control is, I don't think there's anything going on in those countries right now with that. You're talking about hospitals don't have beds for people or returning people back. That's the same with everything else going on. So mosquitoes are not, there's no control going on right now.
Okay, let's go to our next caller, Dr. Alito. Dr. Zambrano.
Actually, this is Mrs. Zambrano, RN.
Okay.
Hi. I work in an urgent care, and we all know that anything can come to the door. Many of these people might consider what they have not to be as major. And then how can you make the distinction between basic flu and gastroenteritis and Ebola?
Dr. Wong.
And again, the first screening question that really narrows it down very much is, have they just within the last 21 days been to either Liberia, Sierra Leone, or Guinea, or have they been in direct contact with a known patient who has Ebola? And so most of the people who come into your office that have those symptoms aren't going to have that history of the travel history or that exposure.
Okay. Reminder, you can press 0 to get into the queue with questions. We encourage you to continue that. We've got a few more minutes here on the call to be able to take questions. I want to remind you that you can get resources on TMA's Ebola Resource Center at www.texmed.org/Ebola. You can also go to the nurses page, which is www.texasnurses.org. Well, let's go to our next caller, Dr. Burdick.
Hi, this is Dr. Burdick. I'm an intensivist in San Antonio. My question is, what imaging studies and how would we get them to and from, and what, if we had to get a CT, how would we decontaminate it?
Dr. Fisher.
Imaging. And I was just going to hit with the CT. If they're going in with the CT for decontamination, you decontaminate as you would do for anyone who has an infectious disease, a viral disease, or anything of that sort, that you would follow the same procedures.
Yeah, this is Dr. Cornelius. I think the general recommendations is to do just what needs to be done to manage that patient. So if it requires imaging, it requires imaging. But I think as much as possible to try to limit it to point of care and use dedicated equipment.
And I would,
Dr. Wong?
I would add, just in terms of thus far, the diagnosis process has been, looking at the symptoms, looking at the travel history, then there's some lab work, primarily the liver function tests, platelet counts. The main things that have been looked at that met the criteria then that CDC would do the PCR testing and DSHS for the Ebola testing.
Okay, we have another call from Westlake.
Hi, it's Dr. Dedush. I work in Westlake and I work in the ED. And my question is, if we have a patient with suspicion of Ebola, should we treat him in a regular patient room, or shall we have a dedicated part of room or a room of the ED that is, for such cases? And if the recommendation was just to use a regular room, then should we have an area in that room for us to change to a PPE or you know, decontaminate? Thank you.
Ms. Ross.
If you do have a negative pressure room, excuse me, you could use that. The negative pressure isn't necessarily recommended except for when you're doing aerosolized generating procedures. But if you don't have a negative pressure room, even just a room with a door is preferred versus a curtained-off room. And again, the CDC is putting out more information specifically about that. If you don't have an anteroom or a room outside of the negative pressure room, what type of procedures you should follow about donning and doffing PPE. Again, that should be put out by the CDC this week.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Ross. I want to remind you, you can press zero to enter into the queue to ask a question. You can also leave a message on our voicemail, and we will have someone follow up with you with your question. And as a reminder, you can also go to www.texmed.org/Ebola for the Ebola Resource Center of TMA, as well as to www.texasnurses.org for more information, as well as the Department of State Health Services website, which is www.dshs.state.tx.us. Let's go to our next caller. Doctor?
Robert Nolan. Hi, Family Medicine in Boulevardy, Texas. Former military, look at this kind of as a natural defense failure, but my question is, what, if anything, are we doing to protect our blood supply other than the honor system on the questionnaire and the basic intake? Is there anything else that needs to be done? Thank you.
Dr. Cornelius.
Yeah, I can't speak specifically to what testing, if any, the blood banks are doing, but certainly if somebody has a fever and appears ill, then they're not going to be eligible for donation.
Okay. Thank you. Our next caller.
This is Sue, and I just wanted to know, since Ebola been out so many years ago in Africa, why is it just now being knowledgeable about in the United States?
It's
Dr. Fisher.
I think it's because it is a very rare disease, and they have small outbreaks that are very infrequent in Africa, and we've never had an Ebola, you know, case in the U.S.
And also, this is the largest outbreak. I mean, typically they've been able to be well controlled. This is the largest outbreak in West Africa. I mean, the outbreak in West Africa is the largest Ebola outbreak that we've ever had, and it has not been readily controlled. It's gotten out of control here. And so, plus that, in addition to the fact that we've had now the first cases outside of Africa.
The number of cases here in this outbreak are totally are more than all of the other outbreaks totaled together.
Okay, we want to thank you for your many questions. We got a few more minutes before we're going to have to close up, so we're going to ask a few more questions. But for those of you that still would like to enter zero and to enter into the call queue, you'd be able to leave a message leave a question tonight that we'll be able to follow up with you on. You can also go to www.texmed.org/Ebola or to www.texasnurses.org. Let's go to a few more callers. In Westlake.
Yes, my name is Dr. Patak. I just was curious. Nigeria, by WHO, was declared Ebola-free. What are the measures they have taken, and can we implement those in USA? And my second question is, the more I hear about Ebola, more conflicting messaging I'm getting about preventing. They are saying you can have just a mask and have the droplet precautions. And on the other hand, when we see in the hospital, in Dallas especially, there was like two incidents that have taken place and their business is totally down to 25%. So what is it actually, those masks you are saying, you know, they are enough when the nurses are triaging, and on the other hand, you have the helmets and the suits and the gowns which are not even available to take care of in the clinics.
Okay, so, let's answer your question about Nigeria. Dr.
Yes,
Fisher.
Sir.
Was how did Nigeria?
So Nigeria has done the same thing that we are doing. They are doing contact tracing. So they've identified the cases. They've gone ahead and identified all of the people who've contacted those individuals, and they keep them with a temperature watch for 21 days or symptom watch. And those who need become symptomatic are quarantined. They follow the same procedures that we're following now, and that's how you do it, and that's how we've done it always, and so that works. What's our next?
In regards to the PPE, again, there is new criteria that's coming out from the CDC, hopefully posted tomorrow or sometime this week, regarding PPE.
And there's new CDC guidelines that have come out just actually before we started the call, about 20 minutes prior to that. Okay, our next caller.
Hi, I'm on staff at a local hospital in Austin, an oncology unit, and I'm a nurse there, and I know some of my coworkers and I have just been discussing, and we've been concerned about, are there any policies and procedures that are in place or, you know, recommended to protect immunocompromised patients from patients who might potentially be infected?
Okay.
Yeah.
Dr. Cornelius.
I think the precautions that you would take for immunocompromised patients would be the same as you would take for any patient. So certainly you would want to make sure that you're adhering to very diligent PPE on the part of the nurses and other staff caring for those individuals.
We only have time for about two more callers. We have about 25 in the queue, so wanted to let you know that you're going to be prompted to be able to leave a message with your question. And we have some of those questions already logged, but you'll be able to still press zero and leave a question on the voicemail. Let's go to our next caller.
Hello,
Dr. Fetner.
Yeah, Dr. Fetner in Dallas. I'm kind of ground zero for the recent Ebola thing, and I'm curious what's out there in the way of therapeutics, which would, of course, stop the whole mess. I know they've given antibodies from the fellow, the doc, or the worker in Fort Worth who survived the disease to patients, if their blood type is correct. And I've heard they've used some HIV drugs to use for Ebola, and they have this other drug that was unavailable. I'm just curious what's out there, how many years we'll wait until we get some therapeutics for the disease.
Yeah.
Dr. Cornelius.
I know there's at least three experimental therapies that I Googled about a month ago to read about where they are in production and how long it would take to get access to those is unknown at this point.
Okay, let's go to our last question for the evening. Actually,
hello.
We have time for two more. Go ahead, Ms. Short.
Yes, hello. My question is, how long do you know with this new CDC guidelines that the virus stays active on services?
Go ahead, Ms. Ross.
It really depends on if the surface is highly saturated. It has to really be in the right environment. But most of the time, it's not a hardy virus, so outside of the host, it won't survive for long. But longest period, we're saying anywhere from 6 hours to 6 days.
Okay. We want to thank each of you for being on the call this evening. We especially thank each of our presenters this evening and from Department of State Health Services, as well as Dr. Wong and Dr. Riggins, our presidents from Texas Medical Association, Texas Nurse Association. We want to remind you that you can immediately find more information and documents referenced this evening at www.texmed.org/Ebola. You can also, for nurses, go to www.texasnurses.org. And the DSHS website is www.dshs.state.tx.us. This call was originated at the Texas Medical Association, 401 West 15th Street, Austin, Texas. We want to wish you a good night. Thank you for being on the call. And
thanks,
be sure to leave a message at this time for those that were on hold or wish to leave a message. You can press 0 to leave a message at this time.
Thanks, Troy.
Thank you.